Our podcast staff is very grateful to Crane and Gray, the excellent website design people who've put together our website and have done wonderfully well with it. Our guest on this recorded podcast is an old friend, Kay Heimowitz, who is well known as a general commentator on the sexual scene, what one might call it. I don't mean sex in the bedroom sense, but rather the sexual difference between male and female and changes in the role that goes with those so-called gender assignments. And that turns out to be a key to a great deal of what's happening in terms of social change and in terms of dwindling social stability. Kay Heimowitz, good afternoon. Because it is afternoon as we're recording, but this can be heard morning, afternoon, or evening around the world. But how are you, my girl?
I'm very fine. Thank you, Mel.
I've been reading some of the recent articles, and there are always so many in the City Journal and elsewhere. Just recently, a very important one in Foreign Policy magazine. I sometimes look for an epigram and the one I've chosen for now, and there's a certain subtle change in the quotation, is the following. From the Old Testament, male and female created she them. That's the way the feminists would, I think, like us to believe it. Of course, originally it's created he them. But male and female we are, and have always been, apparently. But you would agree, surely, that the meaning of male and female, the meaning of man and woman, and the social definition thereof, has changed, I suppose, historically over all time, but has changed in recent years tremendously.
Well, absolutely. Most specifically in the domestic sphere and in the workplace. With the women's ability to control their reproductive lives and with the birth control pill back in the 60s and then beyond, there's been an increasing movement of women to move into the workplace. But what was never quite fully grasped was the meaning that would have for domestic life, for the rearing of children. And this is a struggle which is continually troubling feminists, but all women, I think, and men, and not just in the United States, but in the developed world in particular at large, and I suspect increasingly in the undeveloped world.
Well, now, bearing on the rearing of children, crucial social change has occurred, if only with regard to basic marital statistics. There was a time when, in general, marriage, or at least two-parent families, was more or less the rule in this country and in much of the rest of the world. That has changed tremendously, has it not? To begin with, we now have a figure of what, some 40%, or is it higher than that, of American children are born, as we used to say, out of wedlock.
Yes.
What was that like, say, 30 or 40 years ago?
Okay, so one of the most famous moments in the arrival of single motherhood as a changing norm was in 1965 when Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote his legendary report on the black family. And at that time, he was very alarmed because about 24% of children born to black mothers were born to mothers who were not married.
Merely 24%.
That's right. Now, among blacks, it's now about 72%.
Yes.
It's about 50% for Hispanics and somewhere around 24.5% for whites. And that number is rising among whites very quickly.
So stated simply, the average American child on birth is born not to two married people.
No, it's about 42% at this point. If you just look at first children, it's 48%.
Yeah. And surely that makes changes in every possible related dimension concerning child rearing and concerning ultimately outcomes with regard to the health, the competence, the ambition, the very sensibility of the child himself, herself.
That's right. There's so much research at this point to suggest at the very least a powerful correlation between family structure and the child's well-being. I think it was James Q. Wilson who said it was so much evidence that even a sociologist had to admit it.
Good line, yes.
But many have. This crosses ideological lines in academia to a certain extent, not in the gender studies world, but among economists and sociologists, there is a recognition that this research is quite powerful.
There's a platitude that obtains, journalistically at least, that there was a great feminist revolution and it achieved a feminist victory. Is this part of the consequence of the feminist victory?
It definitely is. And one of the things that I think people do not recognize when they're touting the feminist victory is that there have been winners in that revolution, but there have also been losers. And my reading of the situation is that among college-educated women who now have their law careers, their legal careers, and their children, and their 50-50 husbands, that is, husbands who are helping, not only helping out, but even in some cases equal partners when it comes.
That is part of the great victory. Husbands have now more or less grudgingly or less so started changing diapers.
Well, it seems to be working out fairly well for those women. Their divorce rates are down. They're marrying a little bit later and with a little more maturity. However, among women with less than a college degree, the story is very different. They are continuing to have children at more or less the same age they always did, or maybe just a few years later. So the average age of childbirth among women without a college degree is still in the early to mid-20s. Yet they are only marrying in their later 20s. So that means a growing number of children born to single mothers. And as we've just noted, those children do not have the same lucky future ahead of them for a wide variety of reasons that so many of the children of the educated married mothers can look forward to.
Well, you just said that those women who defined sociologically are not college educated and defined in economically as of the what we used to call the working class, though now maybe we call it middle class, but we've lost the full meaning of middle class. But at any rate, those less educated women, with all the other things that are correlate with being less educated, are not only marrying later than they used to, but are marrying less than they used to. What is the degree of discrepancy between the one class of women and the other class of women, college educated and more ambitious and more successful? What's the difference in number of marriages actually contracted? How many are married? How many are unmarried in those two separate groups?
I actually don't have a breakdown by group, but I will tell you this, that although we keep hearing about the end of marriage and people are giving up on marriage, they're no longer interested in marriage, it's not really true. About 80% of women have been marrying. It's very hard to project into the future exactly whether that will continue, but that appears to be what most demographers think is going to continue to happen. 80% means that the large majority of women are marrying. The shift that's happened isn't so much that whether they're marrying or not, it's how they understand marriage. And for some very large number of Americans, large percentage of Americans, it no longer has much to do with children. And that's the story that I think really needs to be clarified for the public who simply see this as a marriage. Do people marry? Don't they marry? When do they marry? The real question is, how are they thinking about marriage when they do undertake it? And as I said, less and less does it have anything to do with children.
Less and less does it have to do with children? You mean in terms of actually procreating and having children?
Right.
Or do you mean in properly rearing and caring for the children when they arrive?
No, the funny thing is, among the college-educated who, in fact, at this point, are more likely to be married when they have their kids than lower, less educated women. They are very child-centered, intensely so, hilariously so at times. The interesting thing is that though elites and educated people will tell you that it's, single motherhood is fine and nothing to be criticized or certainly not stigmatized, they will also, I believe, wait to have their children until they're married because they know perfectly well on some level, even if they can't admit it, that their children are better off if they're born into a stable married relationship. And part of the reason for that is that they are going to make their child the center of that marriage for the decades that they're raising those children. And that is the one of the many ironies of the post-feminist victory.
So if you're planning to get born into this world, and even more particularly into the United States culture, you would do well to arrange for being born to a married, middle-class, college-educated couple in their late 20s or into their 30s, because that will simply set you up better in life and make you a more competent and ultimately a more fulfilled person. But you should not, if you're planning to get born into the United States, you should not choose to be born to a single woman of 27 or 28 who's never been married or maybe has cohabited with somebody but no longer is doing so, because that's going to give you great disadvantage with regard to the life you've got to live. Is that a fair summary?
I would change one thing, which is that most of those children born to the single mothers are born, the mothers are a little bit younger than what you're saying, more early to mid-20s.
Well, now, what goes wrong with them? They seem then to be the group fated to suffer more or to advantage less from entry into this veil of tears, namely the United States in the early 21st century. What goes wrong with those kids born to mothers 23 or 25 who don't have married fathers living with them?
Well, a slight caution on that. About 40% of single mothers are actually cohabiting at the time of the child's birth. However, and this is an answer to your question, those relationships are far less stable than the relationships of married couples. And I know that it may seem counterintuitive when we hear so much about divorce these days, but actually the divorce rates are down, particularly among college-educated.
Well, the simple fact there is that marriages last longer and better than do mere cohabitation arrangements.
Right. If you look at the same child from the same class, same kind of mother, who's married, let's say, and one who is not married, that child is three times as likely, the child of unmarried mother, three times as likely to see his parents break up if they have been cohabiting or even if they have not, and three times as likely to experience various sorts of what the experts call transitions, that is a new step-parent, a new step sibling or half-sibling. And what a lot of demographers and social scientists now believe is that those transitions are what disrupt, what make it harder for children. It's not what they're inching towards now, and I don't know whether this is true. Social science is always hit or miss on these things. But what they're speculating at this point is that it's not so much the lack of a father as it is the inevitable instability of the home life that a 24-year-old single mother is going to provide, because inevitably at 24, she's going to look for another partner.
Well, what then are the deleterious consequences or the dysfunctional consequences for the kids that we've just been talking about?
On so many levels, you name the issue, and kids look less successful. So let's start with academics. Children born to single mothers are don't do as well in school. They are less likely to graduate from high school. If they do graduate from high school, they're less likely to go to college. If they do go to college, they're less likely to graduate from college, so on and so forth. They're more likely to have emotional problems. They're more likely to abuse drugs and alcohol. They are more likely to have children at it before they are married. I mean, so this tends to repeat itself over generations. And one thing we didn't mention, Milt, it's been so important to my work and my so much part of my interest, is that this creates a kind of self-perpetuating situation where you've got lower income kids who are going to remain lower income because they are not able to succeed in school in the same way that their more stably set peers are. And on the other hand, you have the children of better off married mothers who are going to probably be able to stay middle class or upper middle class because they have so many resources and so much stability and two parents.
Are these class systems more or less fixed and rigid? Does the working class, and I'll use that term, remain working class? The woman born into working class circumstances remain in those circumstances, and the middle class woman born to college educated, more affluent parents remain at that class level? Or is there social mobility both upwards and downwards?
Yeah, well, we're seeing much less social mobility than we used to. This is one of the reasons why that's happening. The children who are born into the lowest quintile of income are far more likely to stay put there than it was once the case. That on the other hand, the children of the top in quintile are also likely to stay in place. So we have a much more stratified society, much more of a caste society than any of us would want.
Good. Caste is just the word to use. Yeah. The difference between class and caste has often been drawn. Now, does caste here essentially tell us that at the working class and more disadvantaged level are disproportionately more blacks, disproportionately more Hispanics, and otherwise at the upper caste level are disproportionately more non-Hispanic Caucasians?
That is correct. One thing we haven't talked about are the economic trends that are feeding into this sorry story. With the decline of manufacturing jobs, the possibilities for people without a college degree, the economic possibilities, the job stability, jobs with benefits and that sort of thing, those have been declining. College has become much more central or much more key, crucial to achieving that kind of middle class stability, the job, not only a job that you can keep, but also one that will provide you with benefits such as healthcare and pensions. So that also is part of the story of what's happening and why the caste system that I'm describing is so hard to break, because when education is all that important, then you need an environment for children, to create environments for children where they are going to be best able to learn and succeed in school.
Now, you know, I can't resist the following, though it's not in our main track of conversation. But as an old academic, and I've been an academic all of my adult life, until by rather recent retirement, reaching a professor emeritus status. But watching essentially the higher education structure and system very, very closely for many years, and in fact sitting on some boards of organizations like the National Association of Scholars or various others, one thing I'm very aware of, including on the basis simply of my contact with many, many undergraduates over many, many decades, is that it is true, as many critics tell us, that the quality of American higher education is diminished, is reduced, gets worse and worse, more and more politically correct, less and less universal, less and less truly humanistic, and produces people who are not as well educated as, say, those who were produced by the system 20 or 30 years ago, much less well educated, much less, in some ways, socially and politically competent than were their parents. Yet that doesn't have any bearing upon these statistics, does it?
Yeah, I'm afraid it doesn't. Life isn't fair that way, is it? I mean, there's a lot of debate about why exactly college-educated folks experience such a premium in their earnings, in their income, over the non-college-educated. One theory has it that the college degree is simply a signal.
Yes, it is, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, and that could be. That's a signal to employers that this is somebody you might want to hire because they're disciplined enough to get through 4 years.
Of course, what lots of people in the general public may not realize is that when they hire young BAs who've got degrees in political science or in sociology or in English and hire them for junior executive positions, or even if they're out of business schools with only a bachelor's rather than an MBA, and hire them for junior executive positions. Very commonly in the large corporations, what they do is put them through a year's essentially postgraduate work of their own devising to teach them fuller literacy skills, fuller numerative skills, and in general to make up for the deficient education that they've had having paid or their parents having paid $50,000 to $60,000 a year for those 4 years.
Yeah, you'd think that corporate America would be very keen on some kind of higher education reform, but
they should be. But back to the main story. The main story is not our educational decline, which I think is a real and significant and worrisome story. But the main story is changes really in the gender roles, in the social roles, in what it means to be a man and be a woman. You did a very interesting article, which indeed I think also in the form of a book, which got a lot of attention just a few years ago. The name of the book was Manning Up, How the Rise of Women Has Turned Men into Boys, suggesting that not only has female character or female persona changed, so has male persona, and not for the better.
Yes, that book, Manning Up, was largely about college-educated folks, but it has great bearing on less educated as well.
Yeah.
What I noticed was that there was a change in people's understanding or men's understanding about their persona, about how to project being a guy, so that increasingly in the popular media, for instance, there were all kinds of characters who I labeled the child men, that is, characters like those in the Judd Apatow films like Knocked Up. I don't know if you're familiar, Milt, with some of the actors who fit this mold, like Owen Wilson and Will Ferrell and Adam Sandler, most of all Adam Sandler, and numerous others. So there was this new male persona that really reflected, I believe, change in young men's idea, or rather a diminution in their idea of what was allowed for them to be a grown-up guy.
Well, the order of main enthusiasms is in descending order: football, beer, and casual sex.
Yeah. Well, this is partly because so many more people do go to college than they used to. So, it used to be that a guy in his early 20s was already in the workplace. And ready to have a family. I mean, ready to marry and have children. Now, that is not a world that I think we necessarily want to go back to. But nevertheless, it did reshape people's understanding of themselves as adults in their 20s. Now the 20s have become a time of a kind of extended adolescence, what I call a pre-adulthood. My theory is that has been particularly problematic for men who maybe are a little more need of guidance as to how to become a grown-up than women are.
Maybe that's an explanation for the reduced number of available husbands in intact families. One would ask, I ask it only rhetorically, I'm not sure about how old your kids are now, but one would ask, would you want your daughter to marry one of these mad boys?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I think that most of these guys, again, the college-educated guys that I'm seeing, and in fact, I do have a 25-year-old daughter as well as two older kids, is that they come around, most of these guys, but there still has been a shift, particularly among the less educated men. You know, Charles Murray talked about this in his book, Coming Apart, an increase in the number of men on disability roles. They are much more, we're just seeing a kind of crisis of male identity, I think. We know also they're less likely to be getting any higher education. Not just college degrees, but or not just a 4-year degrees, but even community college, they're more likely to drop out of. So there's a ambition gap that seems to be happening to men at least in their 20s, and that affects their possibilities, their potential as husbands and fathers.
There are so many separate elements of our current culture that seem somehow to be hanged together. They represent a pattern, a gestalt, but it's hard to understand the ultimate origins of or the ultimate consequences of the persistence of that gestalt. But some of the elements are the boy male or the male boy that we've just been talking about, the emergence of the so-called alpha female who now is getting top CEO jobs, and those are much advertised and much celebrated journalistically. The hookup culture, which now prevails as a substitute for old-fashioned courtship or even old-fashioned honest sexuality. The hypersexualization of our general public culture, in that leering sexuality is visible everywhere and becomes sort of the key to preferment as well as the key to guaranteed box office success. And in the midst of all of that, the continued celebration of the feminist victory, though feminism seems in some ways rather incapable of serious judgment about the ultimate welfare of women, particularly elsewhere in the world, as for example, women in the Islamic world, where there is more than repression, there is indeed murder. How does all of that tie together? I pose an impossible question for you. I couldn't possibly answer it myself. But one feels the need to make some overall integrative sense of all of this.
Yeah, I think it comes back to the intersection between feminism and the sexual revolution, which, you know, as you know, overlapped quite a bit. Women, I think educated women, middle-class women, were able to negotiate the changes of the 60s and 70s that took away all of those rules, all of those signposts, all of those scripts that told men and women how to act towards each other, what was expected of them. It, you know, stripped away all the norms. I think, like I said, a lot of women were able to, you know, more advantaged women, educated women, women who had all of the advantages of homes where they were taught a lot of self-control and self-awareness, self-consciousness, were able to negotiate those changes with some success. That has not worked in the same way for women without those advantages. So I think that the loss of the institutions, the church, of marriage as a child-rearing institution, the loss of scripts that told women told them what to expect once they reached young adulthood, has been a terrible problem, really a catastrophe for lower income, less educated men and women.
The more things change, the more they change. The French are absolutely wrong when they say plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. It's plus ça change, plus ça changerait. But does one have any purchase on predictions concerning the future. Oh men, oh women, but what are they going to be as men and as women, and how are they going to relate to each other, and how will the responsibilities of parenthood be properly met, et cetera, et cetera. Is there a basis for prediction?
Well, you know, in the long run, no, because technology is moving so quickly that it may be that in 50 years' time, we don't even have women producing children anymore. It's in some artificial wombs or, you know, who knows?
Well, that was visualized by Aldous Huxley in Brave New World, the so-called Bokunovsky process.
That could happen, but in the more immediate future, this is the way I see it. I don't think that we're ever going to see the kind of absolute destruction or dismantlement of so-called gender roles, for the simple reason that women continue to bear children and they continue to be the primary caretakers. You know, in my foreign policy article on women, I looked at the story or the scene in various other countries, particularly in Scandinavia, which is always seen as the gender paradise, and found that even there, women remain the default parent, and men are much more likely to be at the top of particularly the private sector. I don't see that changing. The Swedes, for instance, the Norwegians, the Finnish, have tried everything short of obligatory hormonal therapy to try to equalize things, and they haven't come close. Women still continue to work fewer hours, to work part-time, to be the primary parent.
And so, is that true in this country as well?
And it's true in this country as well. And just think about this, Milt. We always talk about gender equality, but at the same time that we're talking about that, we're also seeing an increase in the number of single mothers, not single fathers. Yes, those have gone up. The percentages have gone up of single fathers, single father households, I mean. But it's minuscule compared to the percentage of single mother households. That's not going to change. And what it means is that you can wish all you want for the age of absolute parity of between the sexes. But instead, you're going in the opposite direction once you break down the family.
Well, what then would the message be to those who are still adamant feminists? Would it be, as even Betty Friedan said to them towards the end of her life, cool it, sisters, let's not overdo this. Would that be the message? That the ultimate demands of feminism are ruinous, even for the lives of females?
No, I want to be careful to make distinctions here. You know, I was a working mother. My kids are grown now, but my daughters, I expect, will be working mothers. I think that's all to the best, that they are able to find things that enhance their lives and bring meaning to them, I think, and use their talents. That's great. However, I think that the expectation that this is ever going to be absolute parity, that it's ever going to, that we're ever going to get rid of all gender roles is foolish in the extreme and creating more tension between the sexes than is going to be healthy for children in the future.
This has been a rich and full conversation. I expected nothing more from you, rather nothing less from you, because you have a long experience in talking with you, and in reading your stuff has acquainted me with your expertise in this realm and your thoughtfulness. But I now will surprise you just a bit, or at least maybe dismay you just a little bit, by dropping another item into the mix. And it's one which really requires response and attention these days, literally this very day, because of a decision about 2 days ago by the Supreme Court of the United States. But more broadly, the question is the coming of the full legitimation of homosexuality as, one, a lifestyle even to be celebrated by non-homosexuals as well as homosexuals, but also, of course, the clamor. And it's a success, ultimately a successful clamor, for the institutionalization of so-called gay marriage. Does that have any bearing upon all of these processes, or is it just autonomous and independent of the main issues we've been discussing?
Well, it is related to be sure. There would never have been the remotest idea of gay marriage had we not shifted our understanding of marriage some 40 years, 50 years ago, when we really detached childbearing from marriage. In other words, once we said, or through the courts, through social norms, through full academic departments and gender studies and that kind of thing, that really there was no reason that children needed a mother and father in their lives, that they could do just as well without it. Once that happened, it was inevitable, I think, that eventually we would get to gay marriage. Now, there was a time where I, not so long ago, where I, realizing that and being somebody who was very concerned about the gap or the breakdown of marriage as a child-rearing institution, was against gay marriage. I got to a point, though, not so long ago, that believing that actually there was no way to recapture that original understanding in the way that we were going. In other words, the gay marriage was becoming I'm speaking as a pragmatist here, was becoming not just a civil rights issue, but it was it was in the way of any discussion about how to proceed and to make the lives of children better in the future and to create more stable families. And so that my feeling is, yes, there is some bearing, but I didn't see a way to go back and say, therefore, because gay marriage is, you know, step number 10 in the breakdown of our understanding of marriage as in ways that was helpful to children, that therefore we had to oppose it. It didn't make any sense to me as a political approach and as a pragmatic approach.
So essentially, you do not, for example, agree with Stanley Kurtz, who has written a lot of articles, many of them in the National Review, who argues that the very existence of gay marriage and its prominence and its celebration in a way undermines and devalues the value of conventional marriage itself and may thus contribute to still further decline in marital rates.
I believe that the trends have been so powerful for so long that it would be very difficult to say, to pick out gay marriage as a primary or even important piece of this unraveling.
You mean there's so much else working against marriage anyway, yeah.
I mean, you know, we really didn't even start talking about gay marriage until the 90s, late 90s. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the out-of-wedlock birth rate at that time. It was already probably around, well into the 30% area. And among blacks in the 60%. So, I mean, you know, we already had done something that was changing our understanding of these things. And I just didn't see why gay marriage was the point at which we said no more. We have a lot to look at to figure out what it is that we can do to create more stable arrangements for children. If we could just get to a point, Mel, where we said, children, it's better for children if you marry, if you wait to get married and then have your children. If we could just get to that point, we would have achieved a big victory.
A last issue comes inevitably to mind as part of the whole mix, but again, not easily assimilable to a simple explanation or a simple theory of everything. And that is the decline in the West among, one would have to say, Caucasian populations, the native populations of this country and of Western Europe, the decline in essentially birth rate and the imbalance in birth rate to death rate, so that you get depopulation unless immigrants come in and fill the gap, which of course they do. In Europe, it's largely Islamic immigrants. In this country, it is clearly Mexican immigrants. Is there a way of accounting for the decrease in the will to have children, Or is that, well, it, can one account for it? Can one, or should one try to do anything about it?
Well, I think you can account for it by looking at modern life and women's role in modern life. That, you know, these women simply do not choose to have large numbers of children when they have other options. They are still very, very anxious to be mothers, very determined to be mothers, most of them. But they don't want to be defined only by that fact, and I do not see that changing.
So that even in this country, where we've now got for non-Hispanic Caucasians a 1.8% figure, that means more people are dying than are being born. You're down as low as a 1.2 in France and so on. You're also down to about a 1.2 in Japan, which is a different history. That's a different kind of racial stock, so to speak, to use an unfashionable term. But there are basic demographic changes in birth rate, which have everything to do with the emergence of a future population in the world and in this country, which we can't yet anticipate, but we know it's going to be a major change.
Yes, well, there's no question about that. I am not a doomsayer on these issues. I think that America has reinvented itself many times. I do think we have a budget problem that presents itself when it comes to having an aging population that we all are aware of, and that will be something that we're going to have to deal with. But in terms of the changing demographics, I simply don't know, and I'm not willing to speculate.
Well, you've speculated on an awful lot at my instigation, and I thank you very much for always interesting and always well-informed responses. It's been a delight talking to you again. Hope we'll do it again soon.
All right, thank you so much, Mel.
Thank you very much, Kay Heimowitz.
Summer birds against a Swedish sky. The